Thank you, Stig, for the reading. You're getting your steps in, going back and forth from choir to. So on the surface, the discussion that Stig just read for us in the Gospel of Mark between the scribe and Jesus would be an example of a very good sort of neighborly discussion. You have two wonderful people, steeped in their religious tradition and steeped in their scriptures, who are having a great theological discussion. And the discussion bears on which is the greatest commandment. And I think that when we read this story and we realize there have been conflicts beforehand, when this scribe comes to Jesus and asks him this question, he's not asking him a question in order to trip him up. He's asking him a question really for everyone else that is gathered around. Knowing the kind of answer that Jesus is going to give, it is an opportunity for everyone else to see that this person, Jesus, who has become somewhat of an enigma to all who are gathered there in Jerusalem, is in fact a very good and devout Jew. And so he asks the question, what is the greatest commandment? To which Jesus answers, Shema, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. The Shema, the words that begin with Shema, O Israel, are perhaps the most sacred words in all of the Hebrew Scriptures. They are the words that every good Jew wishes to be able to have on their lips when they take their last breath. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. Many years ago, many decades ago, I watched the miniseries Winds of War, which was an adaptation of Herman Welk's historical fiction, The Winds of War. How many of you saw this miniseries? Okay. More of you that may have seen it and just don't remember. It happens. Sir John Gielgud plays an elderly Jewish scholar, an elderly Jewish intellectual. In Germany, a person who really has nothing to do with Judaism anymore, the practices of Judaism, because he has become so steeped within the intellectual gifts of his mind, a professor at a prestigious German university, and when he sees all that is happening around him in pre-World War II Germany, and he sees what people are saying about the Jews, he cannot believe that in this country that had given him this esteemed position, this person like himself who had separated himself from Judaism would ever really deal with any of those issues. And so when everyone around him is taking opportunity to flee for their life, Sir John Gielgud, in his position as this Jewish intellectual, remains and stays. And he stays until the time comes when the Nazis come for him. And they come and they put him on the cattle train and they take him to Auschwitz. And there he finds himself in the gas chamber, naked, and realizing that all that he has denied has come to be. And the words that go on his lips as the gas is released is Shema, O Israel, the most sacred words. And so when the scribe says to Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus responds with the Shema. It is an understanding to all that are there that this is a man who understands our faith. And then Jesus goes on to say, and the second is like it, that you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And what is interesting to realize is those are two commandments. One is in the book of Deuteronomy. One is in the book of Leviticus. There are 613 commandments throughout the Torah that good Jews would follow. These are just two. They are not right next to each other, and yet he has pulled them together. Now, is he the first to have done that? We don't know. That may have been what people, good Jews, were beginning to say back then. But he says it, and the scribe hears it, and he says, you have spoken wisely. The writer of the Gospel of John, three generations later, is going to similarly take what Jesus and the scribe have spoken about, is going to say, it is impossible for you to say that you love God and not love your brother or sister, to not love your neighbor. It is impossible for you to love your neighbor, to love your brother and sister, and not love God. The two are completely interchangeable. And what we have here in this discussion of what is the greatest commandment, and this discussion that includes being a neighbor to one another, is a phenomenally neighborly conversation. And it should not necessarily be so. It should not necessarily be a conversation filled with respect and filled with admiration. The Gospel of Mark begins in chapter 1 with Jesus coming on like a bat out of hell, saying that time has come. It is time for evil to be sent packing. And the first 8 chapters of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is confronting evil day in and day out in the form of demons and those that are possessing folks with illness. But in chapter 8, it shifts. And evil is no longer represented by those demons that are inhabiting people and causing illness. In chapter 8, it shifts. And that shift that happens in chapter 8 is evil now begins to become personalized in the faces and the positions of those who are the religious authorities of their community, the Pharisees, the temple priests, the Herodians, the Sadducees. Chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, there's conflict after conflict after conflict of these folks who are the religious authorities coming to Jesus and trying to trap him. And then in chapter 11, it begins to pivot again, because in chapter 11, Jesus enters into Jerusalem for the last week of his life. Enters into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, enters into Jerusalem, and the shift begins right there, because no longer is it the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but now it is the chief priests and the scribes, the scholars that support the chief priests, that are after him and confronting him in chapter 11 and in chapter 12. And after their confrontations, we read that the chief priests and the scribes go off to the side and they conspire to have him arrested and have him killed. And so it would be utterly unexpected that a scribe, and that is what we hear, a scribe comes to Jesus at this moment in chapter 12 and asks him a question. He is the last person that we would expect a neighborly conversation with. He has every reason to be wary of Jesus, and Jesus has every reason to be wary of him. And yet, we see in their conversation a sense of mutuality, a sense of admiration, a sense of respect. We don't see Jesus saying, why don't you come over and join up with me and the boys and the girls over here? And we don't see the scribes saying, Jesus, why don't you push all that aside and come back over here? We don't see them trying to convert one another. Instead, what we see is a conversation in which they see into the heart of one another, even though they may well disagree and have differences. I think about what Stig was sharing with us just a moment ago with his with the sharing of the introduction to the offering. And he talked about his life here at Crossroads and places where he doesn't necessarily agree with everything that Crossroads may espouse. And yet, here he is in dialogue and in conversation and present with all of us, singing and sharing and giving of himself and expecting the same in return. It is that seeing into one another's heart, seeing beyond the issues, that becomes so essential. You know, Mr. Rogers, thank you, Mark Wilson, for sharing Won't You Be My Neighbor with me. And if anyone would like to see that movie, I have a copy, courtesy of Mr. Mark. And I would be most happy to share it with you. Mr. Rogers says, when I say I like you, I'm talking about that part of you that knows that life is far more than anything you can ever see or hear or touch. That deep part of you that allows you to stand for those things without which humankind cannot survive. love that conquers hate, peace that rises triumphant over war, and justice that proves more powerful than greed. Mr. Rogers is not focused on the issues that are divisive. He is focused on where your heart is. He has focused in that place. And I believe that that is exactly what has happened in the scripture from the Gospel of Mark with Jesus and the scribe. They have seen into one another's heart. And though they may well disagree, and we do know that the next few days are not the most positive days in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, we know that they have seen each other. And I think about this, I think about the prayer that Val offered up as we enter into the end, one can hope, of this most divisive of political seasons. And if we are going to survive these days, and believe me, on Tuesday when you watch the returns, there will be some returns that you will rejoice over, and there will be others that will break your heart. Because there is right now within our nation a poison of vitriol that is spewing forth the most misogynistic, racist, homophobic, and bigoted rhetoric that feeds on those who may be lost, may be hurt, and may be hoping for a way out of their struggles. And that vitriol that we hear gives answers. It gives a platform, but it has no care for the heart. And it will consume and grow in power with every soul it takes in. But the antidote to such poison, tempting as it may be to spew vitriol from the other side and thus become the very one thing that we abhor, the antidote is going to be love. The antidote is going to give meaning of what Mr. Ross speaks about. It is going to give meaning to what we see between Jesus and the scribe, to speak to the true heart, the heart that yearns, though it may be sometimes deeply buried, to care and to make a difference. We, like Jesus and the scribe, we are called to be such neighbors to one another, to seek out the places where we can find and speak to the heart of one another. And when I read that, when I read about this, I think about, If we are able to do that, if we are able to speak to the heart of one another, to the depths of one another, I believe that what we are doing is seeing with the very eyes of God. For God, I believe, does not look out upon us through eyes of vitriol and poison. God looks out upon us through eyes of compassion and love. We who are created in God's image have our ability to love as a reflection of that very love that resonates and emanates from the very heart of the universe. Richard Rohr, writing this past week about the mystical tradition, wrote about the fact that what he oftentimes sees in modern-day Christianity is there's this very great focus on love of God. After all, that is what we hear in the Shema. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. But what he says is what is lost but is existent in the mystical tradition is that before there is our love for God, there is first God's love for us. Rohr writes, God is the initiator, God is the doer, God is the one who seduces us. It's all about God's initiative. Then we certainly, it has spoken to us in that way, want to love back the way we have been loved. I want to love back the way I have been loved, but it's not like I've got to prove my love for God by doing things. My job is simply, and I love this line, my job is simply to complete the circuit. That is, God reaches out in love for us. Our job is to complete the circuit by our love for one another and our love for God. Do justly now, I read to you in the Talmudic tradition. Love mercy now, walk humbly now. We are not obligated, the Talmud says, to complete the work, but nor is it ours to abandon it. Our task is to complete the circuit. And I can't think of a more perfect example. And thank you to Carol Ota, who shared this with us at the lectionary, at our lectionary gathering on Tuesday. I can't think of a more perfect example of that neighborliness, that completing the circuit, than the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh. The Islamic Center of Pittsburgh, the neighbors of the Tree of Life Synagogue, which lost those 11 lives and such tragedy visited upon it more than a week ago, to date have raised more than $225,000 for the Tree of Life Synagogue, for their neighbors, to be able to offset funeral costs, to offset medical costs, to offset whatever needs there may be. I can tell you, $225,000 would probably go very far to a new roof, a new heater, a new boiler, any need that the Islamic Center for Pittsburgh may have, but they have chosen to raise the money not for themselves, but for their neighbor. Wasid Mohammed, the executive director of the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh, goes on further. He says, if you need anything, you call on us, including if you need people outside of your service protecting you, you let us know and we will be there. Hearkening to the spirit of the civil rights movement, Wasid Mohammed quotes Martin Luther King in his letter from the Birmingham jail, and he says, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all directly. Your loss, as a Muslim, he says to his Jewish brothers and sisters, is our loss. And he notes that the offer that he is making is simply the very same offer that was made to his community after 9/11 and the rise of anti-Muslim acts and rhetoric. They have been their neighbors, and they return their neighbors. 1 year and 51 weeks ago, I stood in this pulpit for the first time, simply filling in for a Sunday while you all were in the midst of an interim period. When Becca asked me if I would come and preach that day, I merely looked for a Sunday that was free on my calendar, not happening to notice that the Tuesday prior would be the presidential election. And so on the Wednesday prior to preaching, I woke up in the morning in panic, knowing who I would be preaching to, knowing the results of the night before, and wondering what I could say. And so that day I spoke to you about butterflies. I spoke to you about butterflies and their journey from being voracious consumers to ultimately the picture of beauty and freedom. An integral in the transformation of a butterfly is what happens in the cocoon. For inside that cocoon, where it is very akin to a tomb, the caterpillar utterly begins to disintegrate and to consume itself. It enters into its tomb and it begins to consume itself until there's this magical moment that happens in life when imaginal cells, and what wonderful imagination scientists have to call them indeed, imaginal cells begin to emerge. Cells that refuse to operate in the way that other cells that have a new thing in mind. And those cells begin to build wings. And the very thing that will take that voracious consumer into a flight of freedom. We, my friends, are in need of such imaginal cells today. And I am hopeful indeed that they are, in fact, all around us. Wasid Mohammed from the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh, and his charge to his people to raise the funds and to be there for their neighbors from the Tree of Life Synagogue, is to me an imaginal cell. Patrice Kahn-Kohlers, Alicia Garza, Opal Tomate, our imaginal selves, the founders of the Black Lives Matter. I think of the young men and women who 95 years ago said there needs to be a church in Honolulu that is not defined by a single race, but is a church where, in fact, we are all welcome. And thus begins Church of the Crossroads as an imaginal cell. And I made a point to ask, thank you, Robin, you did a great job. Robin went and made sure that the young people could be in here. And I want to ask every one of the young people that was over in Weaver Hall to come stand up here in front with me right now. So that's Eden and your whole gang. And bring your moms and dads up with you. I want this whole gang standing up here. Come on up. Because last week, these wonderful people put together this amazing Dia de los Muertos celebration in which we celebrated the saints who have gone before us. I want you to see the saints amongst us. For And I want you first to look at how empty the chairs are around you and look at how many people are right here. In Deuteronomy, it says, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And the next thing it says, teach it to your children. And the next thing that Jesus says is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And I look at these people and I look at the wonderful lessons that they learn in Sunday school and the wonderful things they do as evidenced by last week in our Dia de los Muertos celebration. And these are the imaginal cells that will shape the future, not just of this church, but of our community and our world. And so when Val asks us for prayers for the division and the discord that exists in our country, and it is palpable and real, let us make sure that we balance what we see in that division and discord with the beauty and the wonder that is right here. So thank you all to our imaginal self. And you can either stay right here or you can go sit down, because we're going to move to the table right now in just a minute. Because I was thinking about this as well. When Jesus gathers the disciples together for that Last Supper, little did they know that they were the imaginal cells of the church. When Peter and James and John and all of the boys and the Marys, Mary and Mary and Mary, and all the other women that were following and present there, when they were gathered around that table, they thought they were just having a meal together. Little did they know that in a very, very short time, the baton was going to be passed from the man who was breaking the bread with them to them. And that they would be in the midst of the Roman Empire, in the midst of a Judaism that was so hierarchical, they would be creating something utterly and brand new, calling forth one another, in which there shall be no Jew nor Greek, no rich nor poor, no slave nor free. That they would be creating that from which hospitals would come forward and other places of charity and gift, and all of those things would come because the one who they had followed had lived into, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, had lived into that, had graced it, had been present, and had shared that presence with everyone that was there at the table. Little did they know that their upper room, which in a few days was going to feel like a tomb, locked behind doors, was in fact a cocoon in which new birth was happening. And here we are. Here we are. And it is our choice. Are we ready to be the people that shall burst forth from the cocoon, or do we need more time in there? Whatever it is, please know there is a world out there that awaits our utter birth, that awaits the love that comes to us from God and the circuit that we will complete in the way in which we shall love God and love our neighbor. And so we get the gift of coming forward and being ourselves participants at this table of imagination, remembering that on the night in which he was betrayed, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and when he had blessed it, he broke it, and he said, "This is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same fashion, he took a cup, and he poured the wine into a cup, and he said, "This is the cup of salvation. This is my blood that has been shed for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And so the table is set, the meal is before us, God is present, and so too are we. Let us come forward and complete the circuit. Amen.